Hey folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday, we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This year, as a part of our fundraising effort to keep Risk in existence during what has been the most stressful year of financial crisis for us ever in our 15 years we've been around, we're looking back at some of the greatest stories that have ever been told on Risk as a way of reminding you how irreplaceable, how truly worth saving this podcast is. Today, we're going to hear a story that I have always considered a landmark moment for us. This is, to say the least, not an easy story to hear. This is a story about child sexual abuse. And the reason it was such a turning point for the podcast in November of 2011, when it first ran, is because it was the first story on that subject where the storyteller went into such detail with her memories of the trauma and told it with such emotional vulnerability. After our first recording session, which brought tears to my eyes sitting there recording with Nancy, I told Nancy I would send her the recording and she could take as much time as she liked to decide if she really wanted us to put it out there or shelve it, or whether she might like to do another recording session. I think it was about 2 weeks later that she said she'd given it a good listen and wanted to do a second session. Then we edited both of those sessions together as one story, and with Nancy giving us the green light on that, we put it out into the world. And I think it was about 2 weeks after that that I got an email from Nancy saying that she'd been in therapy working on the issues this story unpacks for 10 years already. But nothing thus far in her life had been as therapeutic as the experience of working on this story for Risk and putting it out there in the world through us. Now, in the second half of this episode, you'll hear a conversation between Nancy and a therapist reflecting back on the story all these years later. So, without further ado, here is Nancy Sullivan with a story we call Life Worth Living.
I was by myself in my campus apartment, laying on my bed, and I was slapping myself in the face over and over and over again. And I wasn't going to class, I wasn't going to my job, I wasn't returning phone calls, I was just slipping away. And I wanted to rest so badly, and that feeling turned to wanting to die. I filled up a bathtub with water, and I thought, if I just take a bunch of pills and pass out in the water, I won't have to deal with any of this anymore. When I was in the seventh grade, we were going to watch a health class video on sexual reproduction. The energy in the air is just kind of like giddy. Everybody's very giggly about whenever they're talking about penises or they're showing, you know, a diagram or anything like that. And they're showing this like scenario of this older man who lives next door to a young girl. And then eventually we're led to believe that he does sexually inappropriate things to her. I have a girlfriend next to me and she whispers into my ear. She's like, oh my god, that's so sick. I can't believe that we're watching this. And so I'm like, yeah, oh, it's just totally wrong. And I don't even look at her. I'm just staring at the screen, and I just have this feeling in my stomach. I'm like, oh God, this is so familiar. I start to have memories after that point. I grew up in the South, and my closest relatives were me and my brother, Tommy, and my cousin, Eddie. And Eddie was a cousin of my mother's side of the family, and we always used to see them when we would go for vacations. He was about 10 years older than me. Everybody thought it was really, really cute because Eddie and I were spending a lot of time together. Wherever he was, I was. What they didn't know is that secretly, although I was pretending to be excited, I was really very scared. I was terribly fond of Eddie, and I really looked up to him, and I looked up to my brother. My brother was only about a year older than me or so, and it was just cool, like the things that the boys got to go off and do together. They got to like shoot BB guns and, you know, play with knives and stuff like that. And, of course, I was interested in anything that they thought was cool. And I remember I was on the couch with Eddie. We were alone. I think the family had gone off to do Christmas shopping. And we're watching this movie in the dark. He's laying behind me. We're on our side on the couch. And he starts to grab me very, very tight. His hands have just sort of like moved down to my waist, and then they're between my legs. I'm thinking he's gonna be tickling me, but it doesn't feel like anything I've ever felt before. It doesn't feel right. And so I say, what are you doing? And he says, what, don't you like that? And I just start crying, and I'm like, no, I don't. And he just says, listen, you're gonna have to keep this a secret. If you tell anybody about this, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. And so for years, I just never said anything. There was a time it was me and Eddie and Tommy, we're all playing hide and go seek in my grandfather's house, and Eddie takes me in the back guest room, and he locks the door, and he pulls down my pants, and then he puts me on the bed face down. He begins to lick my anus. He puts his fingers inside of me, and I'm just crying because I'm so humiliated and so ashamed, and I can't say a word, because if I tell anybody, I'll get in so much trouble. And he stops and he says, now do it to me. And so he pulls down his pants and he lays on the bed, and I start to copy what he's done. I just remember every single thing about it. I remember even the way it tasted, the way he smells, the tears on my face. I started to stop because I was crying, and he would make me do it better. He would say, you're not doing it right, keep going. And I would just continue. And then after it was all over, you know, he puts up his pants, and then he helps me put my pants back on, and then I would just run out into the living room and just sort of crouch down next to my dad and just pretend like nothing ever happened. I even started to look at old photo albums, and I remember I was looking through pictures, and there's this one picture of me in a red dress in my grandpa's backyard, and I remember wearing that, and it was me and Eddie and Tommy, and we were going to go into the attic that's in my grandpa's barn. He has sort of a barn in his backyard. He makes Tommy go up the ladder first, and I'm supposed to go up next so that he can be behind us in case anybody falls. But he had positioned himself so that Tommy wouldn't see that while he was behind me, Eddie was putting his fingers into my panties on the way up the ladder. this one time we were at the beach and I wanted to sleep out on the veranda of this condo that we had rented. I loved the way that the waves would crash onto the beach and how it sounded and the salt water and all the little sea creatures that I could find. And I asked my mom and she said, yeah, sure, you can do it, but somebody needs to take care of you. So Eddie volunteers and he comes out and he helps me set up a little cot for myself. He says, I'm going to go inside and get dressed for bed, but while I'm gone, you need to practice for me. And he had me put my fingers inside of myself and he says, I'll be back. He goes in and he gets changed and everybody's starting to go to bed and the lights get turned out. And he comes out there and that was the first night that he tried to put his fully erect penis inside of me. I was very, very small. I was about 5 years old. And it was extremely painful. Things started to get a little rougher from that point. He would go a little further each time. I had this natural ability, though, to sort of meditate through the pain. I would focus on something. Like, there was a map that I used to look at in my grandfather's attic, and it was sort of 3D. It was three-dimensional. And I used to imagine that I was looking at the map from a bird's eye point of view, and that I was flying over the rivers and the valleys and the mountaintops. Meanwhile, you know, my body is on the floor. I'm on this scratchy carpet, and there's sawdust around me, and there's spider webs in the corners, and it's just got this musty attic smell in the air. Once it was over, I came back to reality, and I would just go inside and just have the rest of my day. After remembering all of these things and knowing exactly what it was, and it was much more difficult to go and be with that side of the family on vacation. I had trouble sleeping. I didn't like to eat. My family sort of chalked it up to me being a rebellious teenager, that I'm just at that stage in my life that I just didn't want to be near them. But I was genuinely terrified that something would happen to me again. Even though the abuse had stopped, like, years before, I was still very scared that it might happen again. I was also very confused because Eddie seemed to be so normal. He didn't seem to be having any trouble with what had happened. He just pretended like everything was fine near me. And I remember just, like, if I had to sit next to him on the couch, I didn't like it. I would just sort of, like, clench my jaw and my hands would sweat and it would just be very, very tense. When I was about 16 or so, Melissa, my older cousin, was getting married, and I was supposed to be a bridesmaid in her wedding. But by this point, I had been sort of involved with theater, and I had gotten into this play, and the show dates conflicted with her wedding. And when I learned that not only was I going to be in the wedding, but I was going to have to walk down the aisle with Eddie, I just started to make a plan. I was going to tell my mom that the play was very, very important to me. They really, really needed me to be in the show. And so I was just going to have to put the wedding off. She was like, well, you know, they can't change the date around. You're just going to have to put your family first. I don't understand why you would want to be in a play more than you want to be in the wedding. Don't you love your family? And I'm like, yes, of course I love my family. But it's just not enough for her. And I can't pretend anymore, and I can't put it aside any longer. And so I say, look, there's something I haven't been telling you. When I was a little kid, Eddie used to molest me. And she says, are you lying to me? And I was so shocked. And so I say, of course I'm telling you the truth. But why would I? She's just convinced. She's like, tell me the truth right now. you can't lie about something like this. This is a horrible thing that you're talking about. You have to tell me the truth right now. What's going on? And I'm like, that is the truth. I don't want to be in a dress in a wedding with this awful person that did this awful thing to me. How could you just not believe me? And it's just, she's there and she's looking at me and I just need so much help from her and she won't give it to me. And she says, look, I'm gonna tell you something. The same thing happened to me when I was your age. I was molested by my cousin, and I never said anything. I just got on with my life, and that's what you're gonna do. You're gonna suck it up, and you're gonna be there for the family. And I just refused. I just said, no, I can't. I can't do this anymore. I need help. We need to tell somebody. You have to help me. And she wouldn't. And, eventually she decides. She decides that, that if I keep it secret, if I lie to the family and I tell them that I'd rather be in the play, that I won't have to be in the wedding. And it's not precisely the best case scenario, but, you know, it gets me what I want. So that's what I did. I remember she made me call Melissa and tell her to just count me out. And to this day, I think that Melissa doesn't, she's not very fond of me because of it. Years pass and I'm just pretending my heart out that I'm the perfect daughter leading the perfect life, and I'm just happy and I sing and I dance and I do plays and that everything's fine. I did find a lot of joy in theater. I even went on to college to become an actor. The first year was good. I made some pretty awesome grades. I started partying a lot. I was sleeping around with a lot of guys that were not stellar for me. Doing drugs. Just being a wild child, basically. It gets to the point where I'm thinking to myself, God, something has to change because I don't think I'm going to graduate. I talked to a friend about it and he said that he had been seeing a counselor. And I'm like, oh, that, I just, you know, I don't think I'm crazy. Why would I need to see a counselor? And he's like, look, trust me, you don't have to be crazy to go into therapy. So I gave it a shot. And we just peel back onion layers until we get down to the meat of it. I didn't realize how far that it had affected me. And that how hiding it from my family and being told to keep it a secret was far more damaging, maybe even than the abuse itself. My mom had told me, you know, you're going to break up the family if you tell anybody. But my therapist said this thing to me, I'll never forget it. It just shocked me to death. She says, don't you realize that your family's already broken and it's not your fault? And that was the first time that I ever had to sort of realize that I had been blaming myself for many years. I had just assumed that I was worthless. And I just started to turn all of my anger towards my mom. And we were having these horrible, horrible fights on the phone. And it was just a terrible period of anger. I started to fight with my brother as well. There was one phone conversation we were having And he didn't understand why I was so angry at everybody and why I was picking fights with my mom. And, you know, he's going on about this, and I just blurted it out. I was like, look, I was abused when I was a kid. And that's why I'm in therapy right now. He takes a breath, and his voice just drops very low, and he just sounds so heartbroken. He goes, what did you just say? And I said, I was molested when we were kids. And it was a family member. And he just stops. And then he comes back on the phone and he says, why would you lie to me? And I say, look, I'm not lying to you. I'm telling you the truth. And he says, no, it can't be true. We were always together. He was always where you were. I was always there too. I would have seen something. And I'm like, look, you were a kid. You were only a year older than me. And there were times when it happened when you were in the room. And I told him this story about how we were alone. We were being babysat by Eddie. And we had set up a tent in the living room. And Tommy was playing video games. Eddie and I were in the tent. And he started to touch me. And I didn't want it to happen, so I started to crawl away, and Eddie grabbed me by the ankles and put his hands over my mouth, and I couldn't call for help, and he just said, you're crazy, you need help, this is sick, I can't believe that you're making this up. And it's just deja vu all over again. And I'm so sick of having to fight and defend myself over something that wasn't my fault. And shortly thereafter, I remember this was when Hurricane Katrina had just hit New Orleans. And my uncle was down there living right outside of the city. He was by himself. And I was calling just to check on him and see if he was okay. And he's there on the phone with me, and he's like, hey, look, you know, there's somebody else here that wants to talk to you. Hang on just a second. And it's Eddie. And he just has this normal conversation with me about how's college, this is what I'm doing, I have a job, blah, 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 blah. And I'm in the middle of all of this therapy, realizing, like, how much he's hurt me. I can tie back the effects of what he's done to me to be indicative of my academic failure, you know, all this stuff. I'm just, like, furious with him. And I can't believe that he's just normal. He says to me, you know, I'm dating this girl. She's into theater. She does all of this stuff. She, you know, she really reminds me of you. And that just made me feel so disgusted. I just said, look, I gotta go. And I hung up the phone. For the next 3 days, I just couldn't get any sleep at all. And I don't know when, I don't know specifically the moment it started, but I had begun to think about what wouldn't hurt. I just started filling up a bathtub with water. I don't even want to leave a note. I don't feel that I owe anything to anybody else. I don't feel that I have to explain myself. And I started lining up all of the pill bottles that I had along the edge of the tub, and hopefully I could just pass out in the water and I would drown and I wouldn't have to deal with anything anymore. So the tub was full, and I turned off the faucet, and then I glanced at a photo of me and two of my best friends. And I thought to myself, what are they going to feel when they hear that I'm gone? I thought, how long is it going to take before somebody finds me? What will I look like when they do? something shifted in me at one point. It's like I just went into autopilot, and then I had a phone in my hand, and it's like this other person in me is calling this suicide hotline, and I'm like, look, I'm having trouble. I might kill myself today. I need help. And I spent 17 days in a hospital undergoing treatment and psychological evaluation. During that time, I lost my job. I had to drop out of school because I had missed so much. And there was nowhere else for me to go. Since I wasn't a student anymore, I couldn't live on campus any longer. And I had to move back in with my mother. I felt very isolated at that time because everybody else was going off and graduating and leaving me behind. But I started going to sessions with this older gentleman. He asked me, you know, are you taking any medication? And I told him about all of the pills I was taking. And I rattled off 4 different prescriptions. And he was like, whoa, 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 how many pills are you taking? And I was like, this. He goes, that's a little extreme. Have you considered stopping the pills? And I was like, no. Don't I need them? And he's like, nah, just go ahead and stop. Let it get out of your system and then let me know how you feel. And so I did. This guy is listening to me and going through all of these events with me, and it just seems like he really cares, and then he really hears me, and he understands what I'm going through in a way that reminds me of how my father used to take care of me. My father died when I was younger, when I was about 12, and he always told me, you know, you don't have to do anything you want to do, and you know, you've just got to be yourself. And this was like some of the same advice that this guy is giving me. And it just brings me to a place of stability that I honestly thought I wasn't ever going to achieve again. We even discussed that he thought, you know, maybe my brother really does believe me, and that just deep down inside, nobody wants to believe that their greatest fears have come true. And it took me years to come to that realization, so I can't expect him to just shift overnight to my side. If it never happens, I need to be okay with that, which is a hard pill to swallow. And I had to learn how to forgive my mom. I was very angry that she didn't take care of me and she didn't, you know, get me the help that I wanted. And I would just keep on going about, like, well, if she had, then I would have done this, and everything would have been so much better. And he says to me, since you can't change it, what are you going to do from here on out? You know, I just had to learn to distance myself from them. I'm an adult now. I was a little less hopeless about the future. I started to believe that I could finish school and that I could become somebody, and that my abuse didn't have to define me. And then the world was sort of open to me. Life is much better for me now than it was then. I don't live at home anymore. I don't even live in the same state anymore. I'm trying my best to pursue my dreams here. I have my friends all around me again. And I do go back and visit every now and then. And it's a very interesting experience for me. Because sometimes when I'm in a plane and I'm headed back to New York, it feels like I'm headed back towards a home that's been there for me all along. I definitely feel like I'm carried towards a life that's worth living.
Thank you. no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweater, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no bed, ain't got no mind, ain't got no mother, ain't got no culture, ain't got no friends, ain't got no schooling, ain't got no love, ain't got no name, ain't got no ticket, ain't got no token, ain't got no God. And what about God? Why am I alive anyway? Yeah, what about God? Nobody can take away. Got my hair, got my head, my brains, got my ears, got my eyes, got my nose, got my mouth, I got my smile, I got my tongue, got my chin, got my neck, got my boots, got my heart, got my soul, got my back, I got my sex, I got my arms, got my hands, got my fingers, got my legs, got my feet, got my toes, got my liver, got my blood, I've got life, I got my freedom, I've got life, I've got life, and I'm gonna keep it, I've got life, and nobody's gonna take it away.
This is Risk. This is the Beta Band behind me now. And we just heard from Nina Simone. And before that, of course, we heard the story Life Worth Living by Nancy Sullivan. It was first recorded for Risk in 2011. Now, in 2023, we invited Nancy to re-listen to her story along with Cindy Nielsen, a licensed professional counselor, so that the two of them could record a conversation about Nancy's story all these years later. You can find Cindy at skylightcounselingcenter.com. And here are Nancy and Cindy now.
So I'm Cindy. I'm a psychotherapist. I'm practicing in Chicago. We're currently getting our very first snow of the season. I am a longtime listener of the podcast. I found it, I think, in 2017.
Nice.
And it changed my life. I remembered there was a little caveat on one of the episodes where he was mentioning it would be helpful to have some therapists in here. And
yeah.
And so I thought, well, I'm a therapist and I love the show, so
yeah.
Want to help? and he sent me over a bunch of stories, and yours was one of them.
Oh,
and nice. Yeah.
Was that the first time you had heard it? Like when he sent them over?
No, I remembered your story.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I had remembered it. It stuck with me as incredibly courageous, right? Just and really just speaking to, like, think the purpose of storytelling as a way to heal that relational trauma.
Yeah, getting it outside of yourself, like putting it into a journal, for instance, or like just doing something with it. You know, there was something I heard somebody said, like, words are like magic. Like, something that happened doesn't necessarily exist until you've heard it.
Ooh. Yeah.
You know?
Words are so magical.
Yeah.
They're so powerful.
Yeah.
I think, there's so many places that I want to go. mm-hmm. think, with you in this exploration of the words that you put out into the world,
right?
You know, 12 years ago.
Like, yeah. I will acknowledge, you know, like the, like my, I was like listening to the podcast a lot too. Like, I was like, I moved to New York and I was doing improv and stuff, and I had been like obsessed with the state. So like, I knew, you know, like I like when I pitched the story and finally got to talk to Kevin, like I didn't even acknowledge it. I didn't want to be like, I don't know.
Like,
I don't know.
I don't know. How,
yeah. Like, I try to like keep a cool exterior. I was like listening to the mission of the podcast and I was like, well, that fits, because I was silenced.
Mm-hmm.
And it actually didn't necessarily, like, even though my mom told me never to tell anybody, that actually didn't stop me from telling people, you know?
Oh, cool. I like knowing that. Yeah.
I was like,
I think people would love to know that.
Yeah. 'Cause I was really wanting to do this play, and there was the wedding, and I was like, I want to get out of this wedding and, you know, do the play. And my best friend was also in the show with me, and I was talking to her. I was like, I don't know how I'm going to do this. Like, how, like, I was like, I just confessed it to her, like what had happened. And she was just like, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Like, you, like, I don't know, like, I don't know. I was like, I'm 16, I can drive myself around, so I'm not like, you know, if nobody's home but me, I'll be fine getting places. So,
I don't think I realized you were 16 when that wedding happened. It was her cousin's wedding, right?
Yeah. I was 12. When I realized it, and then like 16 when I told my mom, and then the second person I told was my best friend. So.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow. And what a good person to tell, it sounds like, where they just really had your back.
Mm-hmm.
Were able to say, yeah, you don't have to do that.
Yeah, exactly. And, I don't know, just getting the support from her, I was like, it's not necessarily true that I'm going to ruin things. Like, people will still love you.
Right. I think that really speaks to that thought that was playing around in the background for a long time, but also really reinforced by your mom in that really painful conversation where it really felt like you'd be breaking the family up.
Yeah.
And that was such a big fear. I mean, you really, really thought that.
And it was like, I mean, even though, I don't know, she was telling me that, it's not, I don't know, I still knew that she was wrong, like that's not really what should happen. But I just felt defeated. I was like, I can't win this battle, you know?
Yeah, and it's mom.
Yeah. So it was just like a little bit of shock to me, because, you know, in seeing these like sex ed videos and like always, you know, even from my parents, hearing like, if somebody does something that you don't like, tell us immediately. So you think these are the steps you're going to take and you're going to get this help. And then it doesn't happen.
Right. It's such a betrayal of that knowledge, right? It's like, but it also speaks to just how different these two processes are. One where we know something to be true, and then the other where we're actually able to put it into effect. We're actually able to act in that place.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it's really, right now I feel really connected to that 16-year-old you and learning this really painful reality of, whoa, the stuff that we talked about, you know, when we would go off and we'd get help, we should seek help, just like you were saying, this is like the should, right? You knew that was what you should do. And then even maybe like, and mom, you need help too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
You know,
like that was there.
Like 16-year-old me needed a voice, and I don't know exactly how old my mom was, but she needed a voice. So, and that's the thing that I kind of, like after the story, and it took me a long time to like even come around to the thought of like, I have a lot of compassion for survivors, and my mom is a survivor. And yeah. I think sometimes people will say like attitudes about childhood sexual abuse. It's kind of like the 50s, you know, it's like something that's out there and you just don't talk about it. These are things you just don't talk about. And she actually grew up in the 50s, you know, so like it was an entirely different world that she had.
Oh, yeah.
And just didn't know, necessarily even know that she needed help. And so therefore was not equipped to help me the way that you would hope for or expect, you know.
That's right. Yeah. It was just, it was normalized.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like the courage to face it and acknowledge it isn't something that's natural for everyone. You know, some people go their whole lives not saying anything.
Yeah.
I think to this day, my mom's the only person, like, I'm the only person that my mom told, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
Have you talked about it with your mom since then?
No. I have done a bunch of boundary setting, though. For instance, when it came time for me to get married and planning the guest list and everything, I was really stressed out thinking about, well, how am I going to do it? Like, I don't want this person to be there, but like, how am I going to tell, you know, my mom that I don't want this to happen or whatever? And like my psychiatrist was just like, you're the bride. This is your day. You know, this is entirely for you and your husband, and you're stepping out there and like, you're already a woman, but you're becoming independent of your family. So, you know, I just like had called my mom and I told her, I was like, I'm in the guest list, I'm focusing on inviting more friends, and I'm not going to invite my cousin. And I will invite my aunt and uncle, but I'm eliminating the cousins. Which unfortunately, like, I had to not invite my my other cousin, my female cousin, who, like, I would have invited her, but it would feel weird if it was like that single person isn't invited, you know? But then again, I wasn't invited to his wedding. But I think it was really like, it was not necessarily well received by my mom. She went along with it, but she just made it clear to me that she thought that was absurd.
I mean, then we can really empathize with how hard it is to be the person to speak out, to set a boundary.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's so much there's so much deservingness that is required to be able to set that boundary. And at the same time, there's so much courage to know that you deserve it and risk even not having those people in your life, if they, you know, because ultimately you're saying this is what I deserve. I deserve to have a wedding where I'm safe.
Yeah,
exactly. I feel good, right?
Yeah.
Like you,
I think know that. Yeah, like the bare bones of that is like you deserve basic human kindness, but you're worth, like you're worth getting what you want and having, you know, respect from others and like respect for yourself, you know, I took a big shift of trying to think of like, what do I deserve? What do I deserve? And what am I worth? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you see those two interconnected for you?
It's still kind of like percolating in my mind, but it's like, it's like a more primal level of like deservingness, but then like your internal like love for yourself and like seeing what you're worth. And that's taken away from you when you're abused as a kid. You feel worthless.
Right. You know? It's like, I think what I'm really feeling connected to right now is just, it's that sense of worth is innate. Mm-hmm. You know, it should be. It should be innate, but the effects of trauma, the traumatic events make us feel like it's less, we're less than.
Yeah.
Or somehow, deserving. I mean, you've done such a beautiful job, you know, throughout these years to get to this, point.
Yeah.
Looking.
I mean, I would like to say that, once the plane landed and I moved to New York, that everything was great after that, but there were still things that, you know, needed help. Like my attitudes towards, sex and relationships took some finessing, you know.
That's a nice word for it.
You know, things got fine-tuned, and I recognized patterns that I needed to eliminate. And luckily, I did, like, my husband did emerge from the mist.
And it was about that.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, he had been a friend of mine for a really long time. We were doing like improv together and stuff. It was always just kind of me being like, oh, this is, you know, like, he's a great guy. We're just friends. It's nice to have like, you know, a platonic relationship with this person. He, you know, he was very funny and cute and everything. But like, we were always just complaining about our love lives and not being satisfying. So it just kind of started as like casual, but then it just became very clear that, you know, we didn't have a desire to see anybody else and the feelings were there, you know.
Well, that's really sweet.
Yeah.
And I think it's also a testament to your readiness for it too.
Yeah. Like what's around the corner, you know?
Yeah. You never know. I like to live my life like that, you know. You just you really never know what's gonna happen. I think I'm wanting to go back to your story. And the moment where you're kind of having that out of body experience and calling the suicide hotline.
Yeah. Like you were talking about the like self-harm, the like I was like slapping myself and how that connects with knowing that the way that I was, you know, treated physically in the past was wrong. It's like your body knows. Even if you don't have the words for it, your body just knows what's not right.
That's right. You know? Yes, and actually that's the way that trauma really helps us to understand what happened to us.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, well, we dissociate. The memories don't get encoded in a way that's linear, or with words. So the way that we respond to a traumatic event gives us really everything we need to know about what happened. I was wondering if actually. Would you like to go into more of that, like just
so people can understand,
yeah, like what your process was like in writing the story?
Yeah. So I was not like trying to be a storyteller. I was mostly like in my performing, I was mostly going with improv. But I felt compelled to tell this story. I'd always wanted to do something with it. And so it was the first story I ever pitched was this story. And then I got like a whole long segment. And I know Kevin has said a couple times, like, when they've rerun the story of, like, this was the first time something of that genre or impact had, like, come through.
Yeah, and I think it was the first time they ever talked about childhood abuse or child sexual abuse.
Yeah. And so I tried to write everything out just chronologically, or I had some sort of narrative that I've always, like, had in my mind about my experiences, or, like, how I would have talked to a friend about what happened to me. So what I was trying to, like, get out there. And it took a couple tries. Like, the first time that I, like, read through it, I came away from it and I was like, how'd it go? And he's like, you might want to try expressing some emotion.
It really didn't come through the first time.
Yeah, completely flat, because I wasn't ready to drop into that.
No, you know, I don't blame you.
Yeah, the recording that did go through, I basically told it chronologically. The person who, like, edits it and does the sound and the music and everything, they themselves have a way of using their own creativity to shape it in a way that works. 'Cause there were a lot of things that were, like, they took this section, cut it, and put it at the beginning, you know?
Yes. Oh, that's what I was wondering about that, actually. Yeah. Because those two scenes that the story starts off with, the one where you're in sex ed, and then the other where you're, I think, in your dorm room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And there's the self-harm happening, the ideation happening. Yeah. But, like, the juxtaposition of those is beautiful, I think.
Yeah. Right? And that was, like, them.
Yeah. Well, you're in really good hands in that. What was it like to actually hear it back once it was edited?
It was great. You know, I was very happy with what they did. I think in years since, I don't know, there are things that aren't relevant anymore or aren't accurate anymore. Like, for instance, going off of medication and not going back to it is not true, because, you know, life happens. I came back around to it.
Yes.
But that was just kind of like, at the time, my therapy team only had so much information. They have to observe you over time to really figure out what's going on, you know?
Right, right. But I think this is really speaking to the importance of having professionals around you to get a diagnosis or get something that really does feel right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is right.
And I had maybe a couple years ago or something, reached out and I was like, could I maybe, if you run it again, because they've asked me a couple times, like, they considered putting it in, like, a book. They considered, you know, or, like, they were going to run the story again. And they're like, is it okay? You know, like, if you don't want to, you don't have to, which is really kind of them. And I was like, sure, maybe sometime. Should we take that part out, you know? So now I get to actually sort of, like, set the record straight.
Hey, yeah. Well, what else do you want to set the record straight about? Is there anything that comes to mind when you think back on the story? Yeah.
The main thing was, like, the medication, and then also just a sense of wanting to acknowledge that, yes, my mom made a terrible choice, but she's also just a flawed human being, and we can all make mistakes. You know, because for a long time, I was like, how do I love this person? You know, how do I continue loving this person? Yeah. How, like, when we lock heads about this specific thing or other things, how do I keep loving her? You know?
Yeah.
And just trying to be, like, I don't know, compassionate for her. It takes a lot to really figure that out, because I, you know, I, I resented her for a very long time. I was very angry.
Understandably so.
Which is like what you should go through. Like, I don't think you should be like, yes, mother, you made the best choice. Like, you know, but also like, if I, you know, I'm in the middle of family planning. Am I going to make all the best choices? Like, I think that I can make better choices because of how much work that I've put into it. But I'm not going to be perfect. Nobody's going to be perfect.
No, you know? and that's a beautiful thing that you've gotten out of your life experiences, which is that there's no such thing as perfect. Mm-hmm. It's about what you do with life that can make it workable. And the reaction, the response, those are really within our control.
Yeah.
That's a beautiful thing that you've been able to really connect to that compassion for your mom, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there was something that I wanted to ask you about, actually, in regards to that. Because I know you said one time you were asked, do you love your mom?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I think it's really clear from what you're saying that the answer is yeah. But how did you get to that point where you're really able to have that compassion and also be with the understandable anger or resentment about what happened in the past?
I think in hearing a lot of other people's stories and recognizing things that other people realized that I hadn't gotten to yet. Which is like why it's so important to have these stories out there to hear other people's stories. How do you do that? I don't know. I don't know that I was like, this is the exact plan and this is how, you know, like it's still amorphous a little bit.
Totally.
I think one thing, there was something that she told me once that I felt a bit of like pity for her, or like I want, like just something that she described that I was like, I wish that I could have just taken that little girl and like loved her, you know, or taken care of her, because she was saying that she was like diagnosed with epilepsy.
Mm-hmm.
But she was saying she was never sure if that was actually accurate. She said that she would get into these states where she was almost catatonic and she would just sit and stare. She couldn't hear anything. She wouldn't respond to anything. She would just sit there and stare. And I'm like, I think you were dissociating.
Yeah.
You
sounds
know?
Right. Yeah.
And the physical toll that it takes on everybody. Like you can't, you can't help but just want to be compassionate about that. It's like, it's such a hard thing to have happen.
Oh, yeah.
It was just kind of like, I just wish that somebody out there had all the right information and that she could have gotten that help, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she'd just been in a different environment.
Yeah.
So then I think it's sort of connecting you to not just your mom, but also to the whole environment around her, that those feelings of resentment, they are directed at the actions or the inactions of your mom. But that it's not that simple. It's not just about your mom. It's about the whole system.
Yeah. Yeah. And how it's just like, so another friend of mine who like I went to school with, who was most likely in that same classroom with me when I was watching that video. She actually is like a public advocate for like a childhood advocacy center, where she speaks about her experience of being, like molested by a family friend. And, and I, you know, she did like a TEDx talk and she, like, when I saw it, I was like, oh my God, you know, and I wrote to her, I was like, thank you so much for sharing that. I wish when we were growing up together, I wish I had known. And, like, you're not alone. Like, this happened to me. And then she wrote back to me and she was like, you're not the only person that's reached out to me saying the same thing. It's so pervasive. Like, it just happens. Yeah. I mean, it's not the standard. It is unusual to experience, it's also kind of universal.
It happens so much. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not talked about, by so many still, and our system still fails people who have gone through abuse, who have just really been traumatized. And I think it's connecting me to just sort of how powerful that the fear of being rejected or the fear of getting in trouble if you speak out is actually pervasive too in our culture, that when people aren't believed, when they are...
But that's the standard... sorry to interrupt. That's the standard abuser thing too, of like, you're going to get in a lot of trouble. Be quiet. Don't tell anybody.
That's right, and that's partly why it's so effective, because our society is failing the people who need our help to know that they've done nothing wrong, that this is not their shame to have to carry.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, and I don't want to become like, if I do wind up having kids, I don't want to be so hypervigilant that they have no experiences, but I just like, if anything happens that I can't prevent, if they go through something, like, I just want to do whatever I can, you know?
Yes. Yes.
Like just to,
you will.
Like, for instance, my friend that I was just talking about who does like the public speaking, like, her, she told her mother eventually, and her mom was like, nobody teaches you how to deal with this in mommy school, so we are going to talk to our doctor, and we are going to find somebody who can help us. And so she speaks for the organization that helped her. And, like, you know, for a long time I was like, I wish that's what could have happened for me. But you can still wind up in the same place of healing, you know, on two different paths. It's just different, you know?
Yeah. So. Right. Right. I think, I mean, that bartering with ourselves, with our past is just inevitable. It's part of the process. It's But it sounds like, you know, the way that you were able to access your understandable, justified anger, which is one of those parts in the story that I love the most, when you're just like really, really in touch with how furious you are, right? Yeah. That, like, this is such a powerful thing for knowing our boundaries, for knowing right and wrong, and trusting that. It's like, you know, it makes me think about how your relationship with anger must have changed over time. I mean, it's going to be there when you, if you are a mom, right? That, like, that it will be there, and you can trust that it will, you know, it'll show up when it needs to show up.
Yeah. Sorry, you mean like anger in terms of like being protective, or?
Yeah, exactly. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like not that it would be like out of control anger, but the kind of anger that is really just in touch with what is right, what is wrong, and looking out for this little person who needs you to do that.
Yeah, there is a bit of fury that happens there. I protected my mom, like, I guess, okay, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but if we're going back to what are things that you would have wanted to set the record straight about, is that, like, I have a hard backstory, but I have a lot of joy in my life, so I'm not, like,
I'm not sad all the time or angry all the time or, you know, depressed all the time. Like, I have, like, a lot of joy and positivity in my life. So that was one thing that maybe I just...
Absolutely. I think like that's worth celebrating.
Yeah.
So maybe it just felt like that didn't get to come through as much as it can now.
Yeah.
Oh, one of the things I really wanted to ask you is, you know, that thought of I'm going to tear up the family.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What was it like to give that up?
My first woman therapist that I ever talked to got a lot more out of me than any men had. And she helped me realize that, like, you can live a joyful life, you can be happy. And she specifically said that to me, you know, when I was saying, like, I don't want to mess up the family. We were talking about maybe I should have, like, another conversation with her in therapy or like, should I be alerting the whole family, et cetera. And I was like, well, you know, she doesn't want the family to cave in on itself. And she was like, it's already broken.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't break it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So it was so specifically, yeah.
You were feeling so responsible.
Yeah. And even if you think about it, like, so I was my abuser. Were they entirely evil? You know, like, what happened to them?
Yeah. And that
You're not born to, like, it's not just a natural thing that you are led to do, like, what happened
right.
there.
Right. And that is always then the question, right? It's like, mm-hmm. where did they learn this and what happened to them?
Yeah. But so it's so much bigger than one person is responsible for, you know, like, so it just, that did take some weight off of me. It made me sad for a long time, you know, sad that I held that sense of blame and responsibility. And then, you know, also sad that there was, like, a better way, you know, like, sad that I didn't have the family that I wanted. I didn't have, like, that loving family that you see on TV. There was a lot of, like, media, like, a lot of TV movie families that I'm like, God, I wish I was part of that. And even, like, in my friendships, like, my best friend, her mother was like, oh God, if she could have been my mom. Mm-hmm. There are actually two women that were like that, and I really did have a feeling of, like, I wish that was my mom, you know. But I don't know, eventually it's just kind of like you have to let go of that and just do the most that you can with what you had. You know what I mean? I don't know. That's still something I guess I'm working on or trying to figure out, you know.
You're talking about acceptance, and it's an ongoing journey.
Yeah, can I sit there? Can I live my life in striving and wishing for what I didn't have, or, like, find the joy in what you do have?
Right.
You know?
And it doesn't mean that they're mutually exclusive, too. Mm-hmm. That there can be both. Both a real loss around what you got or what you didn't get. And also, there's then, I think when we're really able to be with that loss, a sort of an opening up and allowing for choice and agency, like, but
if those feelings should happen to you, like, you should express them, you know, and live through them, and, like, you know, pushing it down and denying it and trying to live a lie, essentially, That's harder. That's a lot harder.
Yes, it takes so much energy to do that. Yeah. And I think a lot of people anticipate that doing it another way, going into therapy is going to make it even worse. It's going to be hard work. And it's not that it isn't, right? It is hard work, but, but it's already hard to live in a way where you're not able to be fully present.
Exactly.
Authentic.
Yeah. 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 That's exactly it.
Yeah. Well, there's so much in what you just said. I think you just clearly have done a lot of really powerful work
I think, and I don't want to like pat myself on the back or, I mean, like, yes, I'm proud of myself, but I'm not perfect. And like, I still have a lot to learn. There's still things that pop up and I'm like, ooh, that was a weird reaction to this thing. How can I do better?
That's the thing, right? It's like that, the fact that you know that, the fact that you know I'm not perfect and I'm going to get to places along the way where I'm like, whoa, what was that? Is part of the healing process, because I think there often was, at least for me, there was this idea in my head of I'm going to get to some ideal way of being where everything is just really easy and it feels good and I'm happy all the time. And that's just not the way life works, right? It's just, it's not, and change itself is also not linear. And, you know, really learning sort of to be able to be with the reality of the way human life is. Is very, very central to living a life that works.
Yeah. I did a lot of work to get where I was 12 years ago. I'm in a different place now. Where will I be 12 years down the line?
Ooh.
Like, that'll be fun to think about.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, you know, you 12 years ago in your friend's room. Right, where you told the story.
I don't think we mentioned that. Yeah, like that the... Okay, so
we
do the second recording, and I did not do it in the sound booth. I think there was like some... Maybe just some scheduling issues or whatever. Like, they left a microphone for me at the improv theater. I picked it up. And at the time, I was living on my best friend's couch because... I was living with, like, I was subletting from someone who was an alcoholic and had started, like, what pushed me to leaving immediately was that one night he got mad at me for not doing the dishes and broke a bottle at my feet.
Good job leaving.
Packed up and left that night, you know? And so I was currently living on my best friend's couch, and I was like, you know, I still want to do this and make it happen. And that was the ideal environment for me because she was like the second person I ever told, and she was always so accepting of me. And I'm like around her things, you know, stuff that I remember from high school, and like just the feeling of your best friend, like that was like the best place that I could have been in for it. And I could just like let it go and just remember like how I told her, and I had to break against someone, you know, like she sat there with me as like all the tears like flowed through and everything. And that was kind of a sense memory of like how I was actually able to get to the point where I did have the emotions.
Yes, you know, and you really did. And it was so powerful. Yeah. I didn't know that she was there with you. And
she was not there with me. Oh. She had to work.
She was there in spirit, like in the room.
Yeah, it was her essence.
Yeah. It just speaks to those relationships where you can say it all. You can, you are able to tell her, you know, how important she is to you.
Yeah.
And, I think the place I was imagining us going. I love that. It's a beautiful, side quest into just like, yeah, the power of friendship. And this particular person is so important to the story too.
Yeah.
I think it's got me connected to both the importance to acknowledge, her and you. That actually, I wasn't anticipating really, and you know, feeling this gratitude for your friend, but knowing the backstory now, it's so clear that this, you know, this friend was there with you throughout so much of the story. And when you think back on that experience with her, and also when you think back on just, you know, where you were at 12 years ago, you know, is there anything that you want to say, almost like as if we could time travel, is there anything you'd want to say to that, you know, older version or younger version, I mean, of you and your friend?
Ask me in 12 years, I guess. I think just that she's not just my friend. Like, I didn't have a perfect family, and so, sorry. Like, I got to choose my sister.
Wow.
She's the one I need to call. Oh, you're good at your job.
Oh my God, you're good at being human. We're doing it together.
Oh. I'm going to a nice dinner tonight. I'm gonna treat myself this evening.
Good. Yeah.
I really wouldn't be here without her.
Yeah.
There's no way.
That's beautiful. Yeah. Oh, she's so important. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, she moved away several years ago. So I think there's just like, I was so lucky to have her accessible and nearby when I needed her, you know, we're apart now. And it's just, there are times where I just need that hug, you know?
I do.
I think I want that right now.
I wish I could reach to the screen right now.
I'll make my husband do it.
Yeah, where's he at? Well, not that you need it right now.
Yeah, he's at work. We're going to dinner tonight for our anniversary, so.
That's great. Yeah. That's so great, right? It's your anniversary.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, thank you. Really. Like, thank you for...
Thank you.
Just being so vulnerable and raw and just accessing this experience again. Yeah. It's such a, you know, it's like we got such a different part of the story.
Yeah.
And it comes with all of its own emotional waves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, like you were saying, you don't want to like re-traumatize yourself, but like you can't, like it's, the fact that a lot of this stuff is so near the surface to me is like, A of all, when they reached out to me, I was in the middle of doing like this new therapeutic journey. So I have like a lot of resources and I was like in a really good place. But just like the ability to have that accessible is the way that you are going to be able to heal, you know, because if it's so stuffed down, if you don't acknowledge it, you can't make any change.
Yep. Yep. You cannot change what you cannot see.
Yeah.
You can't do it. But, yeah. 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 There's, so yeah, I think having access to the things that we know that work for us, whatever yeah. they are, and they're different for everybody, but to really know what they are is, like, the most empowering thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. The power of friendships, too, is, like, yeah. such a strong theme here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've really been craving, I think, sort of the feeling of being surrounded by like, sisters, really. Mm-hmm. My sisters. I have two sisters that are on opposite coasts.
And oh, wow.
That is hard.
Yeah.
But then, you're talking about the chosen sister that you have, and I really feel that there are, yeah. there are chosen sisters, yeah. and they're everywhere. There's exactly. There's so much potential.
And I do feel like there's a lot of mothering that I did get from her mother.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in a sense, like, she really is family for me, you know?
Yeah.
Well, so, you know.
Well, you know what also is cool is that, like, we have, well, like, our brains can't necessarily distinguish between what is a memory, what's happening mm-hmm. right now, right? So, even imagining that your friend's mom is like your mom, mm-hmm. or like imagining a childhood with her, can actually be yeah. incredibly healing.
Yeah.
To like rework yeah. some of those memories. It's never too late to be yeah. able to heal.
Right. And like my like fertility journey right now is rough. But I think that there are, like, I hope that it works out, like, or whichever way that I go, like, you know, we're like, I would like to be a mom, but I equally am terrified of that. Mm-hmm. But I think that, like, a great way to heal would be to mother myself the way, you know, like, yeah. to be the mom that I wish I was, you know, like,
yes,
or that I wish I had.
I was totally tracking. Yeah. And, honestly, I think you're already doing it.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, you're preparing yourself, to be a healthy and whole human being so that you can parent.
Mm-hmm. So, if that's what you want, then yes.
Yeah. yeah. Taken a lot to get there, though, because it's not easy to think to yourself, like, you know, I didn't have the best role model, I didn't have the ideal circumstances, so how can I do any better, you know? Mm. But like,
yeah.
like being determined to try, you know,
that's everything.
So, yeah,
yeah. And I think in some ways it's like more important than even having the right modeling. It's just that will, that
mm-hmm.
to strive for something that you know is out there.
Yeah.
Or is here.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Well, that is all for this episode, folks. Thanks so much to Nancy Sullivan and Cindy Nielsen. And folks, you really and truly cannot hear this kind of programming anywhere else. We had hoped to be on stable footing financially by the end of this year. And I'm afraid to say, we're just not. So, if there's any way you can become a member at patreon.com/risk, or raise the amount of your donation there if you can, or make a one-time donation at paypal.me/riskshow. That would truly mean the world to us and really and truly help keep Risk running in 2024. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.